are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, March 21st, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks, pinch hitting for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Elizabeth Catt on what you are getting wrong about Appalachia. We're taking on J.D. Vance, hillbilly essentialism, and what really is driving the coverage and the politics of the Appalachia region. Maybe they're not Trump country. Maybe we're all Trump country and all not Trump country. Plus, the Austin bomber has died, blown himself up apparently, after being confronted by police. Donald Trump congratulates Vladimir Putin. Ben Carson continues to talk about Candy's dining set choices.
I've dismissed myself.
Trump did not mention election meddling, did not acknowledge the democracy deficit in Russia's elections, but has simultaneously promised that the arms race is getting out of control and he and Putin need to talk about it, but at the same time the United States is going to maintain complete supremacy in nuclear weapons. That's great. Conservative right-wing anti-reproductive justice Democrat Dan Lipinski fends off a challenger, Maria Newman, in an unfortunate result, along with the nomination for gubernatorial candidate in Illinois of billionaire J.B. Pritzker, who will take on a fellow plutocrat in that state's gubernatorial race. 29 were killed in a bombing in Kabul, targeting a holiday crowd celebrating the Persian New Year. And back in the trivial and mundane that might affect our world, ex-Playboy model Karen McDougal sues Trump to speak about alleged affair. Democrats are not only in position to take back the House, possibly make inroads in the Senate, they are targeting more state legislative seats than they have in decades. Long, long past due. And back to Illinois. Denounced by his party, Arthur Jones wins an Illinois congressional primary. That is the Holocaust denier who has been described as a Nazi. In a couple of decades, I'm sure that will be, or maybe even less, the norm of Republican politics. And Israel admits to bombing a Syrian nuclear reactor in 2007. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Guys, Sam has pneumonia. He's really sick. So he needs to rest and kill it and take care of himself. We need to definitely not go late. In fact, we're going to end early today because this snowstorm has actually happened. It kind of shocks me. I never believe weather predictions, but this one is like coming through. Yeah, it's pretty bad.
It seems to be accumulating out there too.
No, it's happening.
I wore snow pants in today.
I layered and wore like actual snow boots. It's on. Hopefully this is the last of it because I hate it.
Can't stop the pods though.
Can't stop the pods. Can't stop, won't stop. I was going to go to the well for another Jordan Peterson joke, but what can I do? So there were these series of bombings in Austin that were apparently targeting people of color. We don't know what this guy was about yet. I mean, I think we can make some pretty safe guesses, some educated guesses, obviously. Will this fall into sort of, kind of just random, you know, these Reddit threads, which were attributed to him of, hey, I don't care. I don't have any particular agenda. I just want to kind of sow terror and kill people. Or does this have a white supremacist terrorist bent? I mean, it remains to be seen, obviously. My sense would be there's really, in many respects, not as big a contradiction between those two possibilities as we might think. I'll just quote briefly from the New York Times. A suspect in a series of bombings that have terrorized the city of Houston died early Wednesday, blowing himself up in a vehicle as officers closed in on him, the authority said. Law enforcement officials identified the suspect as Mark Anthony Condit, a 23-year-old white man. Officials did not rule out the possibility the man had accomplices. We do not understand what motivated him to do it, said the Austin Police Chief Brian Manley. Now, this is obviously a terrifying, grotesque story, and there's more to learn about it. And I actually like to kind of de-escalate in general across the board the use of the phrase terrorism because of the policies that come along with it and the presuppositions. There's no doubt in the world that if this was a Muslim person or a guy from the Middle East, that this would be 24/7 on Fox and it would be manipulated by the administration to advance their agenda. And of course, as with other incidents that have implicated people of color or Jewish people, practically radio silence. This was Trump. Do we have Trump's tweet on this? He essentially said, I mean, if you can't find it easily, but essentially to paraphrase, I mean, he said, the suspect is dead. Great job by law enforcement. That was the heart of it. Obviously, this would have prompted multiple tweets if this could be connected to anti-Muslim. This is Trump this morning. Austin bombing suspect is dead. Great job by law enforcement and all concerned. So just kind of generic pep talk stuff. And not even a sort of indication that he would want to get to the bottom of this and see how this obviously could potentially connect to the resurgent and active racism in this country, which is propelled by him and his administration. We are going to take a brief break and we'll be back with Elizabeth Catt talking about the truth of Appalachia. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is historian Elizabeth Catt. Her new book is What You Were Getting Wrong About Appalachia. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Let's start with, the basics. What are people getting wrong about Appalachia?
So I think that a theme that runs through the book that I address, a theme that was built into a lot of the coverage about Appalachia that we saw relevant to the 2016 presidential election and the success of Hillbilly Elegy, is that Appalachia is a monolithic place, that it has one culture that is overwhelmingly white, that it has one narrative to tell, one single pitch. And so, you know, that is the myth about Appalachia that I address most in my work, deconstructing the myth of a monoculture down to a way that we can see Appalachia through many points of reference, many lenses, and many stories.
I'll confess, I never read J.D. Vance's book. I have an allergy in general to any kind of like, because what the irony is, it seemed to me that this book actually owed a lot to a certain type of, you know, literature actually dealing with African-American community, which is a sort of somebody kind of emerges and they say, you know, the problems are actually internally generated and it's some type of cultural thing. And there's this kind of voyeuristic reinforcement of general narratives by somebody who, you know, might be writing about certain things that are real or certain things that are specific to him or their family or their context, and then blowing them up for a whole cultural narrative that lets us get away from talking about policy. So I didn't read J.D. Vance because that was my presupposition about the book. But I mean, maybe you could talk about, I mean, first of all, is that read right? Do you buy my read of it? And then secondly, you know, what was it? Because that book did a lot of work. I mean, it hit the sort absolutely of cultural pulse. Yeah, go ahead.
No, your read is absolutely spot on. The point that I make in my book about Hillbilly Elegy is that you can't understand what Hillbilly Elegy is trying to do. And as you said, it did a lot of work without understanding the rise and fall of individuals like Charles Murray and the kind of conservative theories about race and poverty that come out of that tradition, his tradition. So what I, you know, the takeaway that I have is very much like yours, that this is a take about poverty that is meant to present poverty as something colorblind, while at the same time retroactively absolving conservative thinkers for deploying these stereotypes and myths about non-white people for decades. So, for example, in the case of Charles Murray, you have obviously big, you know, big problematic texts like the bell curve that everyone, well, I think most reasonable people, you know, think that it's a very, you know, wrong text rooted in white supremacy. But then you have the more kind of new text like Coming Apart, the State of White America, for example, that meant to go back and retroactively absolve some of those things by not talking about genetics and race so much, but about a culture of poverty. So J.D. Vance is firmly rooted in a resurgence of the culture of poverty. And what's so interesting about this resurgence to me is that it's popular among liberals and conservatives alike.
Well, yeah, that's the interesting thread, right? Because it seems to me that a certain type of, and I guess, you know, to me, liberal in the contemporary vernacular kind of means maybe more like centrist, which I have a problem with that word as well. But that being said, there is a narrative that gets applied to Appalachia. So, right, the conservative pivot is now because inequality and certain things that first, you know, were primarily just taken in the last 20 or 30 years will shrink history a bit. So things like deindustrialization, increasing inequality were disproportionately hitting communities of color. Now they, and always hit certainly places like Appalachia and rural white communities, but they've spread out and they've hit more white people essentially. So now the things that people like Charles Murray could racially pathologize, the stats are catching up on things like divorce. So now they need to pivot and go, whoa, I guess it's not just genetics. It's also this culture thing. And there's also the Thomas Sowell thing. And there was always a culture of poverty explanation of race as well. But so that makes sense why the conservatives would buy into it. But it seems there's this other brand of liberal that, as long as the essentializing is perceived to be of, you know, deserving targets, poor white people, we can use that as another backdoor way to justify similar sets of policies, globalization, exporting jobs, and so on.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think what is aligning conservative and liberal thinking in this regard, and you're absolutely right that at the basis level, it's a conversation about what people with power think people without power deserve. But looking back a little bit further back in Appalachia's history, what we see emerge from the liberal position is a kind of confidence that there is a pipeline that we can, you know, utilize that will get people, bring them out of poverty, mm-hmm. and, you know, transform them into functional middle class people. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of like the logic that drives the war on poverty that poor Appalachians, white Appalachians, but also African Americans mm-hmm. in urban centers can assimilate, can be part of the growing middle class, and that there are market solutions that can make this happen, such as helping to fund education, but also doing economic diversification through things like tax breaks or corporate, you know, granting kind of additional liberties to different kinds of corporations to come and bring new jobs to Appalachia, which is, of course, under the dominion of the extractive industry. So there's the faith that I think many liberals would still like to believe that there are market solutions to poverty that will work. And so this is what, in my view, aligns a lot of conservative and liberal thinking about Appalachia, this belief that there is a crowd-pleasing solution to the problem of poverty in America.
Why Appalachia now? You mentioned, you know, the 60s and Bobby Kennedy. I guess you would know a lot more than me, but it does seem maybe a bit more, you know, noble back then of the idea of kind of like we need to put a spotlight on different areas of, you know, exclusion in the more generalized prosperity of then. But there has been this resurgence under Trump. You know, and then the Vance book, why? Like, what is that doing? What is Appalachia and all of the endless profiles, which I know you have a problem with as well, of going and, you know, talking about the opioids and coal and basically it. That's it. Yeah.
There's a couple of different things going on. On the most basic level, there's a genuine interest in the, you know, the rise and fall of Appalachia because it's been so strongly linked to the rhetoric that the Trump administration, first campaign and now administration is using, the idea that the coal industry can have a comeback, mm-hmm. The forgotten worker, things like that. So it's, you know, it's understandable that people want to, especially the press, want to come to Appalachia to understand how those messages and those new realities promised are resonating. On the, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, there's a lot of, you know, psychological projection happening, I think. And, you know, we're in an incredibly turbulent time. And it is comforting for some individuals, particularly, I think, liberal individuals, to think that we can project sort of things that are toxic onto our region. That there's a place where these kind of problems can be contained, that they're not in our backyard. They're always, you know, going to be somebody else's problem. And it's somebody else that has done this to us, that has brought us to the brink of this moment, not, you know, good white people and wealthy or blue parts of the country. And sort of splitting the middle, you know, between both of those positions, there's the reality that Appalachia is beset by many different kinds of issues. But on the same hand, there's, you know, kind of a perverse curiosity about the region because we know and we should know that if Appalachia can get a handle on these problems, such as environmental degradation, you know, corporate influence in politics, political corruption, things like that, then it might prove, you know, to hold some valuable lessons for the rest of the country. So if Appalachia can survive, then possibly the rest of the nation can survive this moment.
Right. And we're not too far behind. I mean, the other point that you made that's really important is just this idea that again, and this is something that just there's such a pattern of this in these kind of like big think pieces on everything from, you know, here's the one key to understanding the Middle East or here's why there's crime in a city. These one note cultural narratives, which catch a few things and obscure so much, and part of it, and might even obscure other things that are also negative, by the way. It's not just a question of like, oh, you know, here's the real positive truth. It's just the question of really the full template. So maybe could you start with, I guess, also referring back to Appalachia dealing with some of these structural problems, the fact that there's also this, like you said, you know, you could just as easily do a think piece on Appalachia for Bernie and, you know, Appalachia of right. economic populism, union militancy, grassroots ecology.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's the narrative that's starting to form now in the wake of the West Virginia teacher strike.
Right.
In 2016, Appalachia was a place where everyone was like terrified that something happening in the region would affect the rest of the nation. And of course, that was, you know, Trumpism. Now everyone is excited. Well, you know, a lot of people are excited for something that started in West Virginia to kind of cause a, you know, a wildfire and carry over to the rest of the country. So it's interesting to me how quickly that the narrative of Appalachia can switch. But absolutely, you know, it's not my concerns about Appalachia and the narrative and reporting are not that we need like boosterism or that we need more positive narratives about the region. We actually just need more nuance, good or bad. Mm. For example, I think, you know, reporting on the opioid crisis in the region has generally been, you know, pretty good, very realistic. And it's, of course, you know, a very complicated and difficult story to tell. And I think one of the reasons that happens is because there's more partnerships between local media and national media when these stories are produced, because you have to have sort of an insider's edge to talk to some of the people who are on the front lines of the opioid crisis. So more partnerships like that might benefit the region. And again, when we say, you know, better coverage of Appalachia, it's not about sugarcoating the realities here or presenting progressiveness in the region through rose-colored lenses. It's just getting at nuance and reality in a way that's, you know, rare to find in broader coverage.
What about also, you mentioned the multiple Appalachias. So, you know, there's this whole, and I think J.D. Vance emphasizes this, the, you know, the Scots-Irish tradition, which, you know, sure, that's obviously part of it. But there's also, as with all these other stories, within the makeup of Appalachia, there's actually much greater sort of identity, ethnic, and maybe even income diversity as well. Can you kind of get us inside, like, what are the different things working here beyond just, you know, this Appalachia as just a word?
Yeah, of course. So the region encompasses parts of 13 states, over 700,000 square miles and 25 million people. So this is, I mean, just practically, logistically, it can't be contained in a single narrative or through the story of a single person or family or moment in time or an election or a president.
Right.
It's a complicated region. It has a deep history. I grew up in a place called Knoxville, Tennessee, which is what would be considered urban Appalachia. It had, you know, robust racial and ethnic diversity. It had economic diversity. It was not one of the poorer parts of the region. You know, but contrast that to places like McDowell County, West Virginia, which overwhelmingly white, has some of the worst, you know, economic and health outcomes in the region. So both of these places are Appalachia. One is not more Appalachian than the other one. And so people who work tend to work in the region and, you know, try to you know, produce coverage about the region, like to do the mini Appalachias model of, you know, reporting and commentary that, you know, my Appalachia might be different than somebody else's Appalachia. And of course, there are moments when people come together to talk about, you know, the problems that we share or, you know, what is setting us apart. But again, we need to kind of dismiss with this monoculture approach to understanding, this one and done approach to understanding Appalachia, because the problems that I'm going to have in Virginia are not at all like the problems, you know, that people are going to have in Pennsylvania, for example. So diversity
yeah, right.
of narrative, diversity of individuals, diversity of, you know, economics is super important to bring into these stories.
I do want to talk a bit about the Trump dimension, though. So having sort of set that table, now we'll talk mm-hmm. about Appalachia and Trump. I am curious. I mean, and this is actually another narrative that needs to be debunked. I mean, Trump won at the end of the day, actually overwhelmingly with just sort of typical Republican base voters. And there were some, you know, slight adjustments, but at the end, this was not a white working class and certainly not like a white poor victory. You know, his median income of his voter, I think, was in the 70s, thousands a year. But that being said, I mean, he definitely did pick off some voters that were disenfranchised by the Republican Party and the sort of, you know, overt oligarchic message of like a Mitt Romney. And it seems now that, you know, obviously Trump in office is, you know, obviously governs as a pure Republican oligarch and purely for the benefit of the wealthiest. He does obviously still, you know, fuel a lot of bigotry and xenophobia, so plays to, you know, people that way. But there's nothing, obviously, of substance in terms of, you know, health care or income redistribution or reining in banks or all the other things that, you know, you would need to do. If there were some people that might be represented in demographics in Appalachia, like in actual examples of people who might have said, hey, I'm going to give, you know, this guy, this TV guy, a chance because situation is so dire. Do you have a sense that those are the people that are already that the small erosion in his support that he's had, is that represented by people who maybe were drawn to the fake populism?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting question, and it's one that kind of consumes me because I also do political organizing, and it's, you know, important for me to know where people's politics actually lie. But I'll give you an example of what you're just talking about. There was a state senator that emerged as sort of the de facto leader of the West Virginia teachers strike, Richard Ojeda. Mm-hmm. Huge populist message, wildly popular among public employees and workers and teachers. He first came on my radar in 2016 as a Trump supporter. Now, he's a Democrat, and he was a Democrat then in 2016. And he was, a great embodiment, or so he was presented, of this narrative that you just talked about, this, you know, economic hardship, anxiety. We got to give him a chance. The other, you know, death lies the other direction kind of attitude that people thought that they saw in Appalachia. So he has, you know, flipped his support. He is, you know, still firmly a Democrat. You know, he doesn't have, to my mind, you know, there's not much analysis going on about why, what made him flip and why that flip occurred. It seems to be just the obvious. But there are, you know, there are people like that, and how to work with them or what they might present for the future is a really complicated but also important question to answer. I think, you know, when the West Virginia teacher strike happened, people really wanted to see this as part of what might be a blue wave coming for the 2018 midterms. They really wanted it to be, you know, this hopeful sign that Trump country was turning. And I don't think we're quite there yet, but, you know, we're moving, I think, in the right direction.
And what is the relationship between that and the fact, and this is, again, not specific to Appalachia at all, it's in many respects really just specific to the Republican Party, but obviously the fusion of fake populism on real economic concerns with subtext-free xenophobia, racism, and bigotry, that was the winning ticket. So we also have to acknowledge the reality of the appeal of that. And, I mean, what's the sort of state of those conditions as well, in terms of, yeah, that type of appeal?
So it's, you know, it's real. What the view that I take of Appalachia, many parts of Appalachia, the part of Appalachia that I live in and organize and work in, it's not really Trump country. It's people don't vote country.
Yep.
We're dealing with places that are extremely poor, and there's strong correlation between poverty and voting behavior, either by choice or design. Poor people don't vote. And so those are the realities of the region. And I think there's reason to be hopeful in that regard, that through increasing voter turnout, tackling gerrymandering and disfranchisement, that we can make some movement in that regard. But I think also we need to acknowledge that there is, you know, the Trump base is motivated and triggered by racism and xenophobia. And there's not been a lot of polling in Appalachia, so to speak, about this issue, but nationally there has been. And, you know, Trump supporters are still Trump supporters. So it's unlikely that people, I think, are, you know, there's going to be a switch that flips and that people kind of snap out of what has happened to them and come back on board and, you know, embrace something, you know, bend towards the common good, so to speak. So my priority as a person who cares about these issues, who works in the region, is reaching as many people that are alienated by the political establishment. A lot of people here feel let down by party politics on both sides of the aisle. They don't consider themselves political, and they don't do civic engagement. So bringing them gradually into the process is what drives my work.
Absolutely. And final question, I mean, as people, I'm sure everybody watching and listening wants to support your work. I mean, what does Appalachia, quote unquote, or what does the left, what does the populist movement there connected to the populist left everywhere in this country? I mean, what do you guys need? What would be most helpful?
Appalachia needs solidarity. What we need in the region is more people to meet us where we are. Understand that the myth that we're voting against our own interests constantly is a myth. That we have a limited amount of political choices available to us, that has the fingerprints on both Democrats and Republicans. So we need a better range. And I think this is true of the country at large, but especially true about Appalachia. We need a better range of political choices. We need a better range of political candidates. And we need to communicate this to the establishment that this has to happen. Otherwise, we'll never get any momentum or movement on these issues.
Elizabeth Catt, the book is What You Were Getting Wrong About Appalachia. Elizabeth, it's a really important book. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, everybody, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Help Sam get his medications for his sniffles. JustCoffee.coop, use the coupon code MAJORITY to get Fair Trade Coffee Chocolate. Check out the Majority Report blend. Leave us a review on iTunes. If you haven't yet, where are we at on the Majority Report YouTube channel yet? Where are we?
You mean a number of subscribers?
Number of subscribers on the YouTube channel, because we have been just skyrocketing, exploding.
Ever since we passed 200K, we've been just, we're at 243 now.
The things are aligning.
A quarter of a million.
A quarter of a million. So if you haven't yet, go over and like us on YouTube and subscribe on YouTube. Last night on TMBS, Megan Day and I talked about the skills myth, why neoliberalism makes us each our own boss. That was a pretty deep dive. And also third ways, the new third way hustle that they're going to plan for 2020. It involves the skill and tech myth. Matt Binder was in studio. We had even more fun dunking on Jordan Peterson. We also had a lot of other stuff. And then a retrospective on the Iraq invasion, which was a kind of commentary and also somewhat sort of auditory history and visual history of the time, the villains, Bush and Blair, heroic moments from Nelson Mandela and Yashka Fisher. Get the whole thing, patreon.com/TMBS. Check out Jamie Peck Patreon.
Yes, and once again, I have yet to paywall anything, so just reading my work is gift enough for me.
Just read.
But if you want to give me money, you can.
Give her some fucking money. We will see you in the fun half. Thanks.
were a superpower, we are now a hyperpowered. The era of the pajama boy is over.
Hello, this is Mitt Romney.
It's like being, really, like being gay in the 1950s.
Tomorrow's news today.
This is so deep. It's a deep state.
I feel proud of myself about that.
It's like being, really, like being gay in the 1950s.
So-called progressives are actually regressives.
It's like being...
Who's laughing now, Sam?
Help with connectivity.
That's a fucking good point.
I'm suspect of this. This is, that to me, this is red flaggy all over the place. You know, I voted for the candidate who had a Green New Deal, so I feel proud of myself about that, because you're saying that that's a great way to get out of this. I agree.
You seem to be a bit of a glum bucket.
Yeah.